3 Essex Street, unfortunately not yet a physically accessible location. Admission is no charge for ACO members and $5 for non-members. Join us to learn more about the story of Mary Mink on February 18th.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
What is life but the attempt of human beings to be happy and contented in a world which with all its ill has a mass of sun and waters, of trees and flowers, of beauty and love. To realize this at its highest, we need food, clothes, and shelter. We need health of body and balance of mind. We want to know what this world is, how its wonderful laws act, who its peoples are, and how they think and act, and how what they have done in years and ages past may guide us today. We want to see, realize, and conceive beauty in form and line and color. We want to know our own souls and the myriad-sided souls of others, and then to imagine what might be if what is should grow to what we wish.
Just screwed, cause this word is misconstrued. Small countries exempt from food, cause leaders have different views. You choose.
What mean the world to me is being free. Live and let live and just let it be.
Let it be.
Love, peace, and harmony. One universal family. One God, one aim, and one destiny.
Oh yeah. Imagine life without a choice at all. Giving a vote without a voice at all. These be the problems that we face. I'm talking poverty and race. But no matter what the case, we gotta
hold on to this feeling.
Candidate to hate, had to beat on the drum to communicate. For what was to come to those who were hung, they would decapitate the tongue if you would mention the word freedom.
Got people screaming free Bumia Jamal, but two out of three of y'all will probably be at the mall. I'm heated with y'all, the defeated will fall, incomplete and unsolved when the word freedom's involved.
Yo, my forefathers hung in trees to be free.
Rest in peace.
Got rid of slavery but still kept the penitentiary. And now freedom got a shotgun and shells with your name. Release the hot ones and let freedom
ring. I'm a former
ring.
Boat prisoner, Hollywood visitor. Dance for cats segregated on wax. My color got me handy. Cap, Anus, and Andy for the freedom they just won't hand me.
Hold on to this feeling.
So true and it been hurting so long. That's the reason why we named this song. Cause it's not a lot of time. Your heart, body, soul, and your mind. It's so true and it been hurting so long. That's the reason why we named this song.
Listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and that was Jurassic 5 with Freedom. And we began the show right away with a very short clip of the man who we're really going to be talking about here tonight, about his life and his really, truly epic contribution to the liberation of African Americans in North America, and his internationalist epic struggle against imperialism around the world. I'm talking about W.E.B. Du Bois, who, in his more than 60-year-long political career, remember, he was born in 1868, and he died in 1963, and he was politically active until the end. For more than 60 years, he'd been fighting for the emancipation of African Americans in the United States in the face of some of the most horrific oppression imaginable. He was like fighting against racism and segregation at the height of the Jim Crow laws, you know, when lynch mob rule in the United States, you know, and he took it international. You know, he went to other countries. He even went to the Soviet Union multiple times. He went to Europe, he went to Africa, he went around the world and linked the struggle of his people, of African Americans, to the struggle of colonized people everywhere and oppressed people everywhere. He's been recognized as one of the founders of the Pan-African movement. You know, one of the founders of the civil rights movement in the United States. But unfortunately, just like Martin Luther King, historical knowledge of him has been distorted and almost reduced to almost a soundbite in official history. You know how a lot of, I'm sure many of you are familiar with, how so many people only know Dr. Martin Luther King from his I Have a Dream speech. And that's really the only aspect of his life and his career that really is publicized by the powers that be, even now, in the United States. And it's what everybody knows him for. Everybody knows, like, the like certain quotes from that speech and all this sort of stuff that's, you know, especially if we're talking about white people, that's about the only thing they know about Martin Luther King. And W.E.B. Du Bois, who is even lesser known right now than Dr. Martin Luther King, despite all the massive contributions that he made to the civil rights struggle in the United States, you know, almost like a pioneering effort, you know, really got things going in the most difficult of circumstances. And pushed against seemingly insurmountable odds for, you know, more than 60 years in his political career as an activist. You know, how I first came to know about W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, it's not like he's well known. It's not like he's talked about. It's not like he's really focused on when we study history in the mainstream education system. I first came across him in a PBS documentary, and the way this PBS documentary, which was about the First World War, but it had a bit of a segment, you know, a relatively small segment on race relations in the United States during the years of the First World War, which, needless to say, were pretty horrific at that time. Like I said before, this is the height of Jim Crow and lynch mob rule and all this sort of stuff. But W.E.B. Du Bois was portrayed as kind of like this very moderate, compromising kind of figure, you know, this kind of black person who accepts the American dream, you know, wants to accommodate himself to the American dream, wants to accommodate himself to this idealized image of America. You know, and there was this very selective quote that was given saying that eventually an American Negro will emerge with the right to, you know, with the right to, you know, the right to work, the right to live without insult, and like various other things he listed. And these things will not come up once, but they are, quote-unquote, written in the stars. You know, it's this kind of like feel-good quote that you would expect to really be played up by mainstream media when they actually do talk about this guy, which normally they don't even do. And it's the same with Martin Luther King. You know, like, it's only certain select quotes which are viewed in isolation. That's the only thing you hear about him. You don't really know any of the details about his career, the kind of forces he opposed, how he opposed the Vietnam War, how he opposed the exploitation of working people in the United States, and was building solidarity between people. You know, not just black people, but white people, and, like, basically trying to build bridges across the color line. And something W.E.B. Du Bois did as well. W.E.B. Du Bois was an open socialist. You know, like I said before, he showed solidarity with different anti-colonial struggles around the world, showed solidarity with working people's struggles around the world, and really worked to build solidarity, you know, a united struggle against forces like, you know, capitalism and imperialism, things like this, which are beating down people around the world and exploiting them. So needless to say, he had a very different approach. You know, the truth about W.E.B. Du Bois is much more complex than what mainstream history would have you believe. You know, just like the history of Dr. Martin Luther King is as well. So I'm going to play right now W.E.B. Du Bois was really celebrated in the series of stories which the Real News Network did a few years ago about his life and his accomplishments and his struggles. And in this particular clip, it talks about how the contradictions within the civil rights movement at the beginning of the 20th century and how W.E.B. Du Bois stood for a particular position within that movement and how he was opposed by other sections of that movement which took a more conservative and reactionary line. And this is a very interesting clip. This clip about the struggle between him, W.E.B. Du Bois, and Booker T. Washington within the American civil rights struggle. And it's a struggle that really is not as well known today, though it has in many cases it set precedent for many of the struggles which are going on now in the African American community. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
What is life?
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay in Baltimore. On February 23rd, it will be the 145th anniversary of the birth of W.E.B. Du Bois. He's been known as the father of the American Civil Rights Movement, the founder of Pan-Africanism, and a figure of both controversy and one of great, you could say, adulation. Now joining us to talk about the life of Du Bois and what he means to us today is Anthony Montero. He's a professor of African American Studies at Temple University in Philadelphia. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Paul.
So why of many leaders in African American history, there's only a real few that have kind of lasted the century and still remain, it seems, so relevant to today. Why is that true of Du Bois?
I think that's so because he contributed on multiple levels to African-American struggles and to the transformation of America. He was this great scholar, the first person to get a PhD from Harvard, and he writes his dissertation on the transatlantic slave trade, and then he writes probably the first scientific work of urban sociology, the Philadelphia Negro. And then he goes on to found what is in the 20th century, the first civil rights organization, the Niagara Movement. It is this tremendous intellectual and scholarly production that puts him on the map. But then on top of it, he is this unbelievable activist. Everything from civil rights to Pan-Africanism to labor rights and ultimately anti-imperialism and socialism. So he lives 95 years and he's productive for a good part of that time. And he's left a tremendous legacy and made a tremendous impact.
Let me first of all tell viewers, we're going to sometime in the next couple of months really work our way through the history of Du Bois and go through all the big beats of his life. Right now, we're just going to focus on a few things in a couple of segments leading up to the anniversary of his birth. So talk about his split with Booker T. Washington and what that was about.
Yeah, that's an important split at the beginning of the 20th century. He really crystallizes it in one of the chapters in his famous book, The Souls of Black Folk. And he differed with Booker Washington on the issue of education, higher education in particular, whether or not the black college elite should be given a liberal education equal to that that white elites were getting in the top white universities. But he also differed on the question of whether or not black folk should sacrifice civil rights and voting rights for the promise of support from Northern capital for economic and vocational training in the South.
Yeah, talk a bit about what this was actually codified in something called the Atlanta Compromise, right?
Oh, yeah. The Atlanta Compromise speech, and Du Bois named it that. And it was this grand compromise that Booker T. Washington conceived. He said, look, the nation is not willing to grant us voting rights and civil rights, that is the North and South. We're not prepared to live up to the promise of Reconstruction. So he said, look, let's forget that. The nation needed black labor in the past, and as it industrializes, it will need black labor in the future. And what we must do and what black leadership must do is to prepare black people for the coming industrialization and the need for labor that the future held. Du Bois believed, however, that the bargain cost black people too much, that we could not give up civil and political rights, that even if conceivably economic benefit would come from it, we could not defend those economic benefits unless we had the vote, unless we were full citizens, unless we had civil rights.
The Atlanta Compromise had actually accepted segregation as a legitimate thing. That was part of the deal, wasn't it?
And Booker Washington anticipated by about a year Plessy v. Ferguson decision by the Supreme Court, which legalized and said it was constitutional to separate the races under the fiction of separate and equal. What it actually did, and I think Du Bois anticipated this, was to protect white privilege.
So Du Bois becomes a very public figure, if I understand it correctly, by the early 20th century. He's, you know, amongst a couple of the most well-known African-Americans. And he, in fact, I guess next to Booker T. Washington, who he opposes. And is this, in many ways, the roots of the civil rights movement, then?
Oh, yes, it is. Because the path of Booker T. Washington was the path of denying or repudiating the struggle for civil rights, at least for the foreseeable future. The path that Du Bois and his followers adopt is the path of the fight for civil rights. So if, let us say, black folk had chosen in the 20th century, as we went forward, the path of Booker T. Washington, conceivably we would have never had a civil rights movement.
And do you see a reflection of Booker T. Washington type of interest and ideology today? Is there a reflection of that?
Oh, yes. I think among sections of the black middle class and petty bourgeoisie, there are strong resonances of Booker Washington. I argue that the race policies, if you want to call them that, of the Obama administration have more in common with Booker T. Washington's conceptualization of things than they do with either Du Bois or Martin Luther King or the civil rights movement of the 60s.
What's an example of that?
You take his State of the Union speech, where he talks about opportunity if you work hard. You take the example, which parallels this, of counseling black folk that what you need to do is clean up your cultural act, clean up your behavior, and then you will have greater opportunity for fitting in to the middle class and the opportunities that are afforded to it.
We'll work to strengthen families by removing the financial deterrence to marriage for low-income couples and do more to encourage fatherhood. Because what makes you a man isn't the ability to conceive a child, it's having the courage to raise one.
This is neo-Booker T. Washingtonism. And what it does is the opposite of what Du Bois was doing in the Niagara movement, which was to question the color line and to point to the color line and racial disparity and racial inequality as the source of the problems that black people face. The Washingtonites and the Obamaites argue that the problems are not generated externally, but are rooted in the black community itself.
Yeah, you saw that within that back and forth with Reverend Wright, then candidate Obama, I guess it was, more or less talked about being in a post-racial society, that somehow Reverend Wright was stuck in the past.
That's right. That's right. And that's the, you know, that's the great Philadelphia speech that he gives in 2008 on race, which a lot of liberals and even progressives celebrated. But what it was a Booker T. Washington type of speech.
Well, this is just the beginning of a discussion about the life of Du Bois. So please join us for the next part of this interview with Anthony Montero on the Real News Network.
There is suffering in the streets, our leaders say, let it be, we the people don't agree, for this suffering there is no need, but they'll wait until there's a revolution, revolution everywhere, burning of property, more homeless people lying in the streets.
So forget about your wealth. Won't you just get up and help? If history repeats itself, fight to win. Mm-hmm. If you tired of the mind, if you want to change his master plan, won't somebody lend a hand? Fight to win.
We the people cry in vain. We beg the leaders to see reason, to show a little pity. For this suffering, there is no need. But they'll wait until there's a revolution.
They want revolution everywhere.
Burning of property.
More homeless people lying in the streets.
In the streets.
Our
leaders refuse to listen.
They refuse to listen.
They say we the people cannot win. But we'll fight until we win, we win. And we will not stop complaining. No, no. No matter how many years it will take. No matter how many years it will take, no matter how many years it will take,
fight to win.
no matter how many years it will take.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Fight to Win with Femi Kuti. And, you know, we had W.E.B. Du Bois versus Booker T. Washington on the Real News Network there. And showing how W.E.B. Du Bois really was a champion of civil rights in the face of interests that were trying to accommodate themselves to the system of segregation. Back then, you know, as personified by Booker T. Washington, who wanted to accommodate himself, you know, accommodate the movement to the, basically to white America, you know, to accommodate themselves to, you know, to segregation and just kind of, you know, try to integrate themselves into this basically evil system. And W.E.B. Du Bois, like, refused to go along with that. And of course, really, he championed civil rights and took the movement forward. And you know, as Dr. Montero talked about in that clip, that interview, very likely, if we didn't have W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, we wouldn't have a civil rights movement. So, needless to say, he's a very, very pivotal figure in the struggle for black emancipation in North America. And really around the world, too, given he was a Pan-Africanist as well. But he also was a socialist. And his attitude toward his position on the black working class in particular is actually very, very interesting. And how he applied basically Marxist principles to the understanding of the struggle for liberation of African Americans. And our understanding of how that could take place in a class society. You know, in the context of class, how that could be understood in the context of class. So, the Real News Network also analyzed this. So, I'm going to play the clip of that right now. So, please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Welcome back to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay in Baltimore. We're continuing our discussion about the life of W.E.B. Du Bois. On February 23rd, it'll be the 145th anniversary of his birth. And joining us again is Anthony Montero. He's a professor of African-American studies at Temple University in Philadelphia. Thanks for joining us again, Anthony.
Thank you, Paul.
So we'll just kind of pick up where we left off. If you haven't watched part one of this, you probably should, because we're just going to keep going. So if you look at the arc of Du Bois's life, he very early on, he talks about himself as being a socialist. At various points, he says that the race question of racism is really a problem of capitalism. But that also gets mixed in different ways and expresses itself in different ways over its life. So talk a bit about that.
Yeah, that's very important. You know, he studies in Germany and he attends meetings of the Social Democratic Party. He takes a course with the great German sociologist Max Weber, who was identified himself as a socialist. When he comes back to the United States, he identifies with socialism, especially in the 20th century, and with Eugene Debs, although he didn't vote for him. He criticizes the Socialist Party because he differs with it on the question of race. And this will be very, very important. Ultimately, Du Bois rethinks race and class, and he puts them in what I would call a dialectical relationship. They are mutually determining in the framework of American capitalism. Now, that is different from what most Marxists and what most socialists, black and white, were saying at the start of the century. Most were saying that class determines race, or that race was an ideological outgrowth of capitalism's drive to separate the working class. Du Bois argues that they are mutually determining. This understanding will finally be crystallized in his 1935 book, Black Reconstruction in America. And he begins it. The first chapter is entitled The Black Worker. And the second chapter is entitled The White Worker. So he's already looking at the racial dynamics within the working class. But to make a long story short, his study of the Civil War and Reconstruction leads him to conclude that the overturning of slavery, of the slave system, had to do with the Emancipation Proclamation and 200,000 black, primarily workers, joining the Union Army. They joined the Union Army not to fight to keep the Confederacy in the Union, but they joined the Union Army in a crusade to overturn slavery. So they turned the Civil War from a regional conflict into a revolutionary war to overturn the system of chattel slavery. And thus he identifies for that period the black proletariat as the vanguard of the struggle for democracy and for socialism.
And he had some very specific experience too, which is that while he supported the trade unions and the organizing of workers, he ran up against a lot of very racist union leaders.
Well, there's no question. And in fact, he argues in Black Reconstruction and other places before Black Reconstruction that most white workers were hesitant, first of all, to be in unions with black workers. This is in the 19th century. And then as the war, the Civil War drug on, became tired of it and did not see their interest reflected in overturning slavery. In fact, that many of them felt that, well, with the overturning of slavery, there would be all of these workers who would now be competition for our jobs and would lower our wages. And therefore, the struggle against slavery was not organic to the class struggle and the organization of unions and the fight against capital as a whole. Du Bois says, for this reason, slaves become the so to speak, advanced forces of the proletariat struggle, which focus, as Marx understood and had to focus, upon the defeat of the system of chattel slavery.
So what do you think that shows in terms of today? Do you think the equation has changed in any way?
No, I don't. There are variations upon it, but I think in substance that equation remains the same. Take even voting in presidential elections for the party that is considered the party that's more liberal in terms of race. The majority of white working people vote against that party. They see black labor as competitors and as a threat to their privileges, what they conceive of as their privileges as white workers. So Du Bois had it right. Because of this, the most advanced forces, and this often is at the level of potentiality rather than actuality, a lot depends on the circumstances, but the most advanced forces of the working class tend to be the African-American workers.
Okay, thanks very much. Please join us for the continuation of our discussion with Anthony Montero about the life of Du Bois on the Real News Network.
In the opportunity on this visit to Los Angeles to speak to you on world peace and revolt in Africa. These subjects, together with that of the problems of minorities in the United States, form in fact one problem when brought together and viewed in unity. It is that task which I ask you to permit me to essay tonight, and to approach it from the point of view of what we usually call the Negro problems. All so-called social problems tend to merge. They all have to do with human actions and are based on human customs and treat the numerous and intricate relations of human beings. Moreover, particular social problems, despite the names they bear, change and change radically in the course of time. Indeed, social problems change more often and in more ways than physical problems because of the unpredictable variations in human feelings and choices. They are subject to the same physical laws as sticks and stones, but there is enough of what we call will and volition to make it necessary for persons who are studying a human problem or trying to conduct their action in accordance with its present manifestations to keep a wary eye on changes and on current facts. For instance, in the United States during the young manhood of Frederick Douglass, the Negro problem was the problem of slavery. There were, of course, minor and connected problems, but they were all subjected to the main problem of human freedom. Then rather suddenly, between 1863 and 1876, the Negro problem became a problem of political enfranchisement and party government, which rapidly descended into race war, leading to temporary attempts to grapple with problems of work and education. But finally, ending in practical disfranchisement of the entire Negro race in the South in 1876. From 1876 until our day, the race problem in the United States of the Negro has been primarily a struggle to regain the right to vote in the midst of caste discrimination, changing slowly but definitely to a problem of the right to work and to be trained for work at all levels, and to a struggle for broad civil and social rights. Most of you, I think, assume that this is still the Negro problem. But you must be warned that it is not wholly or mainly that now. That the reason that it is not is because of the fundamental changes now spreading over the whole world. Whereas in the 18th century the world thought that progress and emancipation were coming from popular education and universal suffrage, we know now that more fundamental than these important rights is the economic organization of the world. That is, the way in which the labor of human beings is organized to satisfy human needs. This question is so fundamental that all other questions of political power, of education, and human happiness depend upon it. This is the basic reason for the rise of philanthropy, of socialism, and the attempt at complete realization of socialism through communism. It is immaterial whether or not you like or accept socialism or communism. The absolute compulsion of your facing the problem which they try to solve is inescapable. While I am sure most of you realize this worldwide change of emphasis, I doubt if you see how this affects the Negro problem in the United States. Because most American Negroes of education and property have long since oversimplified their problem and tried to separate it from all other social problems. They conceive that their fight is simply to have the same rights and privileges as other American citizens. They do not for a moment stop to question how far the organization of work and distribution of wealth in America is perfect, nor do they for a moment conceive that the economic organization of America may have fundamental injustices and shortcomings which seriously affect not only Negroes, but the whole world. Just as Booker Washington, in his day, assumed that American ideals were complete and right, that all we had to do was to fight to imitate and attain them, so today, we Negroes are largely quite swept away by the miracles of American industry, the huge accumulation of wealth, and the conspicuous expenditure which we find about us. Our idea of heaven is to be rich Americans, to make the kind of show in home, dress, and automobiles that is so popular in America, and to suffer in our effort to do these things, that we should be able to do them with no discrimination on account of race or color. This is dangerously short-sighted. We American Negroes are part of the working force of the world. Not only do we represent an important segment of the American working class, but also of the working classes of Europe, Asia, and Africa, and the other Americas.
In these days of uncertainty, we have to live and here in the United States, where for many it is difficult to earn a living without selling one's soul to falsehood and greed.
A ballad behind bars, or you could say real rock from the rock, an unusual musical happening in a most unusual place. The state prison
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and said they were suckers. They wanted me for their army or whatever. Picture me giving a damn, I said never. Here is a land that never gave a damn about a brother like me and myself, because they never did. I wasn't with it, but just that very minute it occurred to me the suckers had authority. Cold sweating as I dwell in my cell. How long has it been they got me sitting in a state pen? I gotta get out, but that thought was thought before. I contemplated a plan on the cell floor. I'm not a fugitive on the run, but a brother like me begun to be another one. Public enemy serving time, they drew the line, y'all. They criticized me for some crime. Nevertheless, they could not understand that I'm a black man and I can never be a veteran. On the strength of situations unreal, I got a raw deal, so I'm looking for the steal.
Yo, Chuck, we're gonna break you out of here, man. Where's the strength, G?
I'm going for that steal.
Hold up, G. They're trying to put black guy out of the game by keeping you in there, you know what I'm saying? But they can't keep a black man down.
Got it. Got me in the cell.
Hey, yo, Chuck, we got
it. Falling asleep on death row. I grabbed his gun and he did what I said so. And every man's a man got served, along with the time they served. Decency was deserved. To understand my demands, I gave a warning. I wanted the governor, y'all, and plus the warden to know that I was innocent, because I'm militant. Posing a threat, you better up.
government.
Yeah.
My plan said I had to get out and break north. Just like Oliver's neck, I had to get off. My boys had the feds in check. They couldn't try nothing. We had a force to instigate a prison riot. This is what it takes for peace. So I just took the peace. Black for black. It's high time to cut the leash. Freedom to get out to the ghetto. No sellout. Six COs we got. We ought to put their head out.
Yeah.
But I'll give them a chance cause I'm civilized. As for rest of the world, they can't realize a cell is hell. I'm a rebel, so I rebel. Between bars got me thinking like an animal. Got a woman CO to call me a copter. She tried to get away, and I popped her twice, right? No one to get nice. I had six COs, and now it's five to go, and I'm serious. Call me delirious, but I'm still a captive. I gotta rap this time to break as time grows a tent. I got my steel in my right hand. Now I'm looking for the fence.
Hey, yo, Chelsea, got the dope plan in effect. G word to the strap, man.
I'm looking for that fence. Into the courtyard, followed by 52 brothers, bruised, battered, and scarred, but hard. Going out with a bang, ready to bang out. The power from the sky, from the tower, shots rang out. A high number of dose, yes, and something close. I figure I trigger my steel stand and hold my post. This is what I mean, an anti-nigga machine. If I come out alive, then they won't come clean. Then I threw up, my steel bullets flew up. Into my surprise, the wall and tower blew up. Who shot what, who, what, the bazooka was who? Into my rescue. It was the S1W,
yeah.
Secure my getaway. So I just got away. The joint broke from the black smoke. Then they saw it was rougher than the average bluffer. Cause the steel was black, the attitude exact. Now the chase is on, telling you to come on. 53 brothers on the run, and we are gone.
Listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Public Enemy with Black Steel in the Hour of Chaos. And of course we had W.E.B. Du Bois himself speaking about the revolt in Africa. And that was him speaking in Los Angeles in the 1963. It has to be remembered, he was 93. He was basically 95 years old when he gave that speech. And he himself was to die later that year. So he was politically active right up until the end, W.E.B. Du Bois. And one of the things that was very important, you know, he talked about how Marxism applies to African Americans in the United States and how it applies to colonized people around the world. And also he was a champion for the unity of colonized people fighting against imperialism. And that was really a big part of his understanding of Pan-Africanism, which is what the next clip talks about. And this is about his relationship with Pan-Africanism and with Marcus Garvey. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay in Baltimore. We're continuing our discussion about the life of W.E.B. Du Bois, whose 145th anniversary of his birth will be on February 23rd. Now joining us again to talk about all of this is Anthony Montero, who's a professor of African American Studies at Temple University in Philadelphia. Thanks for joining us again, Anthony.
Thank you, Paul.
So Du Bois has been known as the father of the Pan-Africanist movement. What's that history, and what's the significance of that today?
Well, you know, he wasn't the first Pan-Africanist, and he's called the father of modern Pan-Africanism by the first president of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah. And he eulogized Du Bois in that way. But Du Bois makes a tremendous contribution to the struggle for African independence in the early 1920s with his Pan-African Congresses. And what he says, in effect, is that a part of securing world peace is the dismantling of the colonial system in Africa and Asia. He said that World War I was a war over Africa's colonies. If you want peace, you have to dismantle the system of colonialism. Well, that is not to be, but he fought for it. He fought for it throughout the 1920s. However, by 1945, after the end of World War II, there is a Pan-African Congress in Manchester, England. That was the fifth Pan-African Congress. And he was invited by all these young African leaders, Kwame Nkrumah, Jomo Kenyatta, to name two of the very famous ones. And they make him the chairman of this Congress. But now you have representatives of African labor and of the European labor movement. So the Pan-African movement is now poised to become an actual movement in different African countries, Ghana, Sierra Leone, Cote d'Ivoire, Guinea, Kenya, Zambia, and on and on and on. These young people who come to Manchester are prepared to go back and fight for independence. Well, of course, at the same time, the colonial powers have been severely weakened by these two wars. Britain cannot afford its colonies, France can't afford its, Belgium, and so on and so forth. So you have this convergence of possibilities. Now, but for Du Bois, after World War II, Pan-Africanism intersects with the struggle against the rising American empire and the Cold War. And so for him, the Pan-African movement must become a part of the overall global anti-colonial, anti-imperialist, and peace movement. This gets him in trouble. Not the fact that he's fighting only for civil rights, which he continues to do, but that he internationalizes or globalizes the struggle through the Pan-African and anti-imperialist and peace movements.
Now, when I hear him talked about in Baltimore and other places I've been, often you hear people describe themselves as Pan-Africanists, for example, in Baltimore, and they almost equate that with Garveyism, Marcus Garvey, and which is a sort of a kind of back-to-Africa movement, black sovereignty, back-to-Africa. But he actually had quite a division with Garvey.
Yeah, no question. They were distinct forms of Pan-Africanism. Now, of course, Garvey makes a great contribution in raising the consciousness and awareness of African-Americans and Africans of the mutuality of our struggles. However, I think Du Bois's Pan-Africanism in the beginning is more practical because Garvey's did not have a direct anti-colonial program connected to it. Du Bois's did. He was calling for a transformation of international law and the practices of the major colonial powers, which in their own interests would lead them to accept a decolonization process for Africa. Garvey never had that program. However, after World War II, the Garveyist form of Pan-Africanism did not rise to the level of anti-imperialism and the global struggle against colonialism and for peace that we find in Du Bois's.
And then the two men were quite harsh critics of each other.
They were. Yes, they were. But when Garvey dies, Du Bois eulogizes him in a very favorable way. You know, he doesn't hold on to, you know, the anger that fired their differences in the early 1920s. And he says that, you know, he speaks of this contribution of Garvey to an awakening of Africa's consciousness of itself and of Africa America's consciousness of its link to Africa and the struggles of the African peoples.
Okay, thanks very much. Please join us for the continuation of our discussion with Anthony Montero about the life of Du Bois on the Real News Network.
is called Kimole, which means in original English, pin it down. So brothers and sisters, let's all grab our partners and, you know, pin them down like this. I see the problem since left, red, and yeah. Black man never regain consciousness, yeah, yeah. We get the wrong people for government, who force us to think with colonial sense. Now wrong information scatter your head. You reject your culture for Western sense, bringing shame to yourself and your continent. Black man today don't lost himself. Yeah, 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 yeah. Your past, black man, know yourself. Don't forget 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 your past, black man, black man, black man, black man. The first university was in Africa. Black Africans were the teachers then, and people came from all over the world to hear the teachings of our ancestors. Later these foreigners begin make war with us, then fight us and enslave us by force, claiming everything of our ancestors. But I said Black Africa will rise back on top.
Black man, know yourself, because he gets our ancestors. See the light is born.
Black man, know Black man, know yourself. Don't forget your past. 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 Black man, 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 don't forget your past.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. 250 watts of community power.
February is Black History Month, and the Guelph Black Heritage Society invites you to celebrate with us at our events. These events will honor our history and celebrate the diversity that has grown within the city. The Old Stone Church at 83 Essex Street in Guelph, renamed Heritage Hall, will be the site of several events. To kick off the month, there will be a Bob Marley tribute event on the 6th. Following this, on the 13th, join us for a screening of the documentary In the Key of Oscar at Heritage Hall. On the 20th, we continue our celebration at the 3rd Annual Music, Love, and Family Celebration at Heritage Hall. On the 26th, enjoy music from Tracy Kane and Lorraine Harris at the Guelph Civic Museum, 52 Norfolk Street, a physically accessible location. And end the month off with a bang with a Native and African family drumming workshop on the 27th. Despite our best efforts, Heritage Hall is not yet physically accessible. For more information, visit our website at www.guelphblackheritage.ca or find Guelph Black Heritage Society on Facebook. Happy Black History Month.